getting back to talking about the recovery from the COVID crisis. What does it look like for the ag economy and those working to make it hum for farmers? Getting back to normal may be a winding path, but as long as that path leads us to something that looks more normal, I'm willing to go on that walk.
State of connectivity via Farm Journal broadcast. This is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with Professor Maren Bozic from the University of Minnesota. Then we've got Polly Rulin from the United Soybean Board. And in the final segment, editor and captain of cognition, Brian Grady from Pro Farmer. Right after the news, Annalisa Laca from Farm Journal's Milk. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. Now, here's your beloved host, Chip Flory.
Davis Michelson, you sound clear as a bell. Like, this is unbelievable. What's happening?
Yeah. I'm broadcasting from an improved state of connectivity. That's all that I can say, Chip. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, welcome back, non-digitized Davis.
Yes, I'm forced into broadcast refugeeism here. And I tell you what, you know, Tent City never felt so good.
So, you know, the last several months, we've been talking about, and I heard this when, I don't think you were on the show on Friday, when I had heard this just before we went on the air, and I've been saving it for you.
Okay.
We've been talking about how the current situation is pulling forward the future, okay? We're using technology at a pace that, If we would have just let things continue to develop normally, maybe 5 years from now, we would be at where we're at right now.
Right.
Okay? So we've been talking about that since, like, the second week of the pandemic on this show. Right?
Yes.
Last Friday, I heard somebody describe it as the rapidization of digitization.
Oh, my gosh. And also the concurrent decline of the English language. Who uses words like that?
You know,
come
digitization.
On.
Okay. You know what? I think
rapidization
might
that
actually
one
be a word.
That one maybe.
Rapidization?
Dictionary.com. Dictionary.com, future
hey,
boy.
Hey, get out of my way while I step on my rapidization pedal. And squeal my tires.
Well, I'm so pleased to be broadcastificating with you today, Chip. I can say that with certainty.
Yes. Awesome. Yeah. So here we are, rapidizing ourselves back to the future.
I wish I had. I didn't bring my buzzer thing. Nah.
And you know what? We gotta get back. We gotta get to the news because.
Focus,
with
Chip.
Annalisa, we're actually going to be talking about going back to the future. Okay?
Oh, all right.
So let's get going.
Jumping gigawatts. Well, following, let's start with some highlights from USDA's crop progress and condition update for the week ending August 2. Corn, 92% silking, 39% dough, 72% good to excellent. Soybeans, 85% blooming, 59% setting pods, 73% good to excellent. Spring wheat, 5% harvested, 73% good to excellent. Cotton, 91% squaring, 54% setting bolls, 45% good to excellent, and winter wheat is 85% harvested. And Chip, this is an interesting one because the only time soybeans have been rated higher for this report week was back in 94 when the good to excellent rating was at 80%. USDA also put the 1992 bean crop at 73% good to excellent. That's equal with this week's rating. And in both of those years, USDA's yield projection increased more than 5% in the August reports. That's coming up on August 12th. Chip.
1994 crop, I have held out as an example of the most consistent corn crop, most consistent bean crop I have ever seen. And I'm sticking with that. Okay, that I remember that crop that clearly. The 1992 bean crop got frosted off on Father's Day in as far south as central Iowa, and it came back and looked that good at this time. It pretty incredible.
Well, I got to bring this up. Stone X, that's formerly INTLFC Stone, now projects the U.S. corn yield at 182.4 bushels per acre for a total crop of 15.32 billion bushels. The company also projects an average soybean yield of 54.2 bushels per acre for a crop of 4.496 billion bushels. Now, Chip, it's important to note, the company points out these are final crop projections, not their expectations for results of USDA's reports coming out on the 12th of this month. We might need to talk to Arlen about this.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure we will. I don't know which is. I think the 54.2 is probably more impressive than the 182.4.
Yeah.
That's a big move away from the 49.8 that we've got versus a move from the 178.5 that is already built into the spreadsheets.
Well, Chip, the Treasury Department expects the U.S. government to borrow an additional $2 trillion in the second half of 2020 as it looks to increase federal spending in light of the coronavirus pandemic. Treasury Department estimates suggest the government could borrow $947 billion during the period July through September, which would be a record high for the quarter. Estimates also have the government borrowing $1.2 trillion between October and December of this year. And somebody's got to pay for that, Chip, eventually, right?
Yeah, but it's. I don't even want to comment on it. It'll get me started and going down a path that I don't want to go down right now.
Well, Kansas Republicans vote today in a bitterly contested primary between Secretary of State Kris Kobach and Representative Roger Marshall, with some of the party warning that victory by Kobach, who is seen as who's been defeated by Democrats in prior elections, could cost a crucial seat in the U.S. Senate. But populists like Kobach because he criticizes meatpackers and supports mandatory country of origin labeling on meat. Chip.
All right. Thank you very much, Davis. Let's bring in Annalisa Laca, editor of Farm Journal's Milk. How you doing, Annalisa?
I'm doing great, Chip. I was bummed because I was ready to give Davis a hard time. There's a story in our cover story for the August issue of Dairy Herd is about how to get the right connectivity on your farm.
Nice.
But we don't need that anymore because Davis sounds good today.
Thank
yeah,
you,
he does.
You sound good too, Annalisa. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
All right. We're going back to the future. Is that right?
We are. I think the phrase that everyone's talking about this week in the dairy industry is got milk.
Yeah. Yeah. So very popular when it was first launched. Stuck around for a long time, and now we're going back to it, huh?
Yeah, so this campaign ran from 1993, I was five, to 2014. And it included, you know, celebrities like Britney Spears and Michael Jordan, Dennis Rodman. The Checkoff has brought it back, but this time around, it's really aimed at young people. So it's on TikTok. There's YouTubers that are doing videos for the campaign. It's really fun.
Yeah. Well, and the video with Katie Ledecky yesterday.
Man. You saw it? Oh, my
yes.
God. Isn't that cool?
Oh, it's unbelievable. And you know, she gets to the very end, and she's how do I even say it? It's produced by her, and you can't get any better campaign or marketing than that.
No. So for the listeners, Katie Ledecky swims an Olympic-sized pool lap with a glass of chocolate milk on her head the whole
balanced
time.
Balanced on her head.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You got to check it out. Just go to Twitter. I got it right here. Yeah, it's at Katie Ledecky. So just do a search for that. It's fantastic.
Very cool.
So we're getting some good news out there. All right, Annalisa, thank you.
Thanks, Chip.
All right, we are going to be talking about the state of the ag economy. We're going to talk more about the dairy economy. We're going to talk about the recovery from the COVID crisis with Marin Bozic next. No doubt you've heard of MetLife, but did you know that MetLife Investment Management has over 100 years of ag lending experience? The MetLife Investment Management team maintains close relationships with its borrowers and can structure a customized loan with flexible terms to meet your financial needs. Looking to expand, refinance, or recapitalize? Consider MetLife Investment Management. Learn more at MetLife.com/ag.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. It's brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Lorre. Yeah, like I said, we're gonna take a look at the current economic conditions. We're going to take a look at where we are in the recovery from the COVID crisis. We're going to take a look at some of the things that are on the priority list of some of the leaders in the promotion of ag products. And we're going to try to look at and identify what is the best, least winding path that will get us back to where we were pre-COVID. And I understand that just getting back to where we were pre-COVID is not going to fix what's going on with the ag economy, but at least that's a step closer to where we were. And so we're going to talk about that going forward. And I'm going to start that conversation right now with Maren Bozic. He is from the University of Minnesota, where he is an assistant professor of applied economics. And Maren, it's good to meet you, on live radio. How you doing?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just want to start with kind of your assessment of what the demand disruption has done to the ag economy, with some of the vulnerabilities that it has exposed, some of the opportunities that it may have exposed to us. Maren, what do you see happening out there?
Well, navigating the COVID-19 crisis for dairy supply chain has been a little bit akin to swimming through that swimming pool with a chocolate milk on your head and trying not to spill. But now the swimmer did better than dairy supply chain, but I think we've proven that we are resilient, that we are agile, and that we are willing to adapt. Early in the crisis, back in the April, overnight, the restaurants started closing and the food service shut down, and we lost the market for a good part of our butter and cheese. The dairy cooperatives and dairy processors reacted swiftly by working with their patrons to adjust the milk supply. And in the same time, the price gap between U.S. and the rest of the world opened up some export opportunities. Our exports skyrocketed in May, June, July. Probably July. We don't have the data yet. So we made it through. We went from the almost worst ever cheese prices to the best ever. We broke all the records here in June, July, and now we are a little bit on a retreat down, going from stratosphere, hoping for a soft splashdown, just like SpaceX the other day.
Yeah, very cool. You know, the dairy market, it has really kind of shown the way, but that it's mostly in class 3 milk futures. Class 1, 2, and 4, we're not seeing the same kind of price reaction that we are in class 3, are we?
There are a couple of elements there that need to be pointed out. 10 years ago, when we had a global financial crisis and the government was buying dairy products, bulk dairy commodities, and supporting dairy markets in that way, we've learned the lesson, and then in the crisis before that even still, we've learned the lesson that if you buy bulk commodities, if the government buys bulk commodities and stores them in caves, that market will stay low for an extended period of time. We were determined not to repeat that experience this time. That's why instead of buying a lot of powder, storable dairy commodities, government intervened through food box purchases, and it was very well justified because the lines in front of food banks, unfortunately, are only getting longer. That is what caused the class 3 price to skyrocket, because cheese was driving it up. The demand for cheese was, like, when you take everything into account, the exports, the food box program, and retail increases, all of that together was sufficient to compensate for the weak food service demand, and the cheese went up. Now, in the powder, we play by the rules of the global trade. If the global market for powder is oversupplied, our price will be low, and it's very hard for us to lift that price on our own, because we would have to essentially balance the entire world if we wanted to lift the price of powder by 10 or 20 cents. So it's no point trying to intervene there. And then what caused a lot of heartburn in Minnesota and upper Midwest, well, actually throughout the country, here in June is the negative PPD, which measures the difference between the value of the federal order pool and the Class 3 price. And as unfortunate as it was, and as unpopular as it may be for me to say this, but nobody ever lost a farm over a negative PPD. You know, of course, it would be great if the prices were higher, if the milk sheds were higher, but negative PPDs typically, particularly in upper Midwest, they occur when the Class 3 has a strong rally.
Right.
And the so for July, we've seen the Class 1 prices being even higher, and now for June, but probably we'll see the Class 1 prices much higher than Class 3, and the PPD will revert back to the positive territory there. So it's... In all things considered, it's not, you know, it's irritating as hell, but it's not what does you in. Like, what does you in is the prolonged crisis, low prices at the executive at the time when you think that you don't have to do anything about it.
Right.
So, Chip, my biggest fear really isn't what will happen. My biggest fear is what kind of lessons people learn from it. And it's very dangerous to learn the lesson that you don't have to hedge, you don't have to worry about risk because Uncle Sam is going to come with his cavalry, and they're going to just scoop up all the surplus cheese and always increase it. So why bother? And my response to that is always not all pandemics fall in election years. And yes, until November, I would say that I would be surprised if the government does not do a lot to support ag economy. We have to keep in mind that Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania were the three swing states that delivered the Republican presidency in 2016. And even though the polls currently seem wide, I expect them to tighten as we get into fall. Any president would try to maximize the odds of re-election, and that is what's happening right now as well.
Okay.
And besides, you really, really don't want to have U.S. Population be hungry and food banks be empty, because if you thought that June riots were something, wait until you see what kind of
people
riots
are hungry.
Hungry people can make. Yes,
that's exactly right. That is so true. Early on in what we were just talking about, Marin, you said something about bringing some flexibility into the processing side. Is that something that we're going to see more of in the future, so that if we do see a demand destruction again, we can adjust more quickly?
All new cheese plants, a lot of new plants that are being built are built around the idea of flexibility, so they can switch back and forth. In fact, one of the reasons, it can have multiple effects, not all of which may be something that we like. For example, the ability of a few plants to switch between production of mozzarella for exports and cheddar barrels for domestic market is what's causing the spread between blocks, and it's one of the reasons for the spread between blocks and barrels to be more volatile than before. When our export opportunities are strong, then such plants are supplying overseas markets, producing cheese for the overseas markets. When the export opportunities go away, what they do is they just switch the production line, they switch the recipe, and then they make barrels for domestic market, dropping the price of barrels relative to blocks. So I do expect more flexibility going forward. Most of that is going to be benevolent, but we need to closely monitor it so that we don't have some unforeseen consequences.
Okay, not a lot of time left, but I want to get to this. What we are seeing right now, what impact is this going to have on the next time that we negotiate a farm bill?
Probably we will want to put in some automated triggers that will reduce the need for ad hoc bills. And we are very fortunate that Representative Peterson is here in Minnesota is the chair of the House Tech Committee, because it does make sure that our state is very well represented in those negotiations. And I know that Peterson has been trying to create new bills, not just farm bill, but also for the stimulus bills that are being proposed this summer, that will set up the infrastructure to allow the government to move swiftly in case of some disturbance in supply chain. going forward. And that's, you know, with the proper oversight, that's probably going to be helpful going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're exactly right about Congressman Peterson having a very strong and being very vocal in what he is looking for in this next round of COVID relief and how he wants his committee to have a say in it. And boy, I think he would just as soon let this let the existing farm bill play out before we start a full negotiation at the expiration of the current. All right, Maren, thank you so much. It was a joy getting to know you here just a little bit. We'll have you on again sometime.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
You bet. That is Maren Bozek from the University of Minnesota.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
Joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beej, it's a tough day in the markets. Double-digit losses in beans. We've got corn about a nickel lower. Pressure on winter wheat and spring wheat prices, too.
Yeah, Chip, I think a large part of it in the soybean market is the uptick in crop condition ratings yesterday. Unexpected, and really it just doesn't happen a whole lot in the first week of August that soybean conditions tick up. Really high ratings there for this time of year. And I think just looking at the price action today, it looks like national corn and soybean yield estimates are probably on the rise. And as a result, we're putting some pressure on the markets. Corn, it isn't, it's about a nickel lower, so not the double-digit losses that we're seeing in soybeans. But that December contract stopped just a half cent shy of the contract low. If we take that out, there's probably another wave of selling underneath that level.
I would anticipate that they would. Well, that and the funds that are already short, Brian, this does nothing but make them more comfortable on the short side of the market.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. They're not only comfortable, but they're comfortable adding.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So their short is about half of what the historical record is. And so they still have room to add. They're heavily short, but they have room to add if they want to. And there's nothing that's telling them to dial that back at this time.
All right, mixed trade and lean hogs, cattle complex mostly lower.
Yeah, hearing some $99, $100 cash cattle trade early in Kansas, so that should limit seller interest in the futures. We still have the futures out in front of the cash, but should limit the selling there.
Gotcha. Stick around. Let's talk crop tour in just a little bit. Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady, Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. Do you suffer from talking on the radio phobia? No problem. Send us a tweet at hashtag AgriTalk.
All right, welcome back to AgriTalk. Glad that you could join us today. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Let's have a conversation now with Polly Rulin. She is the CEO of the U.S. Soybean Board, the United Soybean Board. How are you, Polly? It's good to talk with you.
Good morning. Good to talk to you, too, today. I don't know if I love or hate following that market report for soybeans, but hopefully we can put some good news in the mix.
Absolutely. You know, but I'm going to start you off with some questionable news. And, Polly, this is... I'll admit this is so unfair of me because the timestamp on this headline that just hit is like 10:27, so like 7 minutes ago, and it's on Reuters.
Okay.
And it's U.S. Energy Department's recommendations to EPA for retroactive biofuel blending waiver requests include partial exemptions. Now, if you don't want to comment on it, I'll give you that is fine because this is such a big issue for biodiesel and for ethanol. If you want more of the details and want to wait for that, I completely understand. But doggone it, Polly, if this headline is right, this is the partial exemptions. This is more mud in the water.
Yeah, couple things about that. First thing is, I'm with the checkoff, and all farmers know, and everybody I think knows that policy issues like this are out of bounds for the checkoff.
That's,
but what I can't see
right.
about biofuels. Yep. But listen. What I can say about biofuels is we have a tough road to hoe on biofuels, even though the American public says that what they want is more economically sustainable, more domestically available fuel. We are constantly fighting this fight. And so I think when it comes to soybean markets, biofuels are critically important. But what we're working on at the United Soybean Board and with the Checkoff is finding lots of other ways we can use the magic bean, right? I mean, we need biofuels. We've got to continue to fight for our biofuels. But we also have to find a lot of other ways to use our agricultural products, especially those that are as flexible as soybeans are. And so when we focus on marketing instead of legislative policy, instead of the news like that, we focus on ways that we can use soybeans globally that will help us diversify our portfolio even away from biofuels, given the sometimes rocky road we have to walk.
Right. Yeah. And Polly, as soon as you started to answer that, I thought, oh my gosh, I tried to pull her out of her lane. I hope you get back in it. And you did.
Oh my goodness.
You did it very well.
I'm very aware of where my lane is. I've worked in checkoffs for about, I don't know, about 15 years now. God, I hate to admit that, but it's true. and we stay in our lane and other people stay in their lane and all is right with the world.
Exactly. Okay. Last week, you had the meeting to decide where the checkoff dollars are going to be invested in the year ahead. What's at the top of that priority list?
Yeah, and as I alluded to just a second ago, the top of our priority list is selling beans, and whether that is food, fuel, fiber, or whatever that end product is, that's what United Soybean Board is involved in. So last week, the 78 Farmer Board voted on investments for our 2021 programs to find all kinds of new things out about soybeans and to pull soybeans through the demand side of the equation. The farmers invested about $68 million that's given to the soy checkoff by farmers nationwide in all kinds of programs. We have weathered some difficult storms, and as of what you said, what did you say, 10/27, it's not, there's still difficult storms to weather, but this kind of investment makes us able to look forward at our markets and make sure that the demand side of the equation globally is strong and is able to pull what continues to be an extremely impressive volume of soybeans that we raise in this country.
And the so many of the countries that are out there that we are developing markets in have unbelievable opportunities for us going forward, just simply because in many cases, Polly, they're discovering U.S. soybeans or soybean meal, the protein available from soybeans, for the first time.
True. And they're also discovering, so not only are they discovering that meal is available for the first time in many of these expanding or expansion markets, we'd call them, but also some of our more mature markets are finding out that using soybean meal for animal feed, for example, has significant benefits over the synthetics that have become popular lately. And part of what our FY21 investment is in is research to understand what natural benefits feeding soybean meal as opposed to feeding synthetic amino acids, for example, hold. And what we're finding is that gut health, the health of the biome in various food animals, as well as piglet health, for example, and growth rate, are all enhanced when you feed soybean meal instead of feeding what may be a less expensive synthetic that's often imported from places like China. So those kinds of research projects are at the core of our meal strategy at USP.
Right. Okay, on the development side of things, Polly, when I do market outlook, you look at the supply side of the balance sheet and you look at the demand side of the balance sheet. And when you realize what the production capabilities are here in the United States, I would sure like to find a way that we could that we could add 500 million bushels of bean demand on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Yeah. So the efforts being made to do that. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, let's, because we know that when we had some regulations passed a few years ago about using about trans fats and using soybean oil in food products,
yeah,
it was the biofuels area that really saved soybean farming's profitability. So that's why, that's when and where biofuels became so important to us. So let's find another thing or two or three like biofuel to help us
right.
get through. So we're, what we're looking at right now, and some of the areas that look super promising to us are tires, for example. So Goodyear Tire announced that it wants to replace all petroleum oils in its product. And they are using, they're increasing their use of soybean oil in 2020 by 25%. And that's only the tip of the iceberg for tire companies. That similar kind of R&D is being used in shoes, like Skechers, for example, okay. is using soybean oil in their running shoe soles. So tires and shoes, pretty big global markets there. But
yeah.
an even bigger, bigger global market for us is asphalt and asphalt sealant.
Yep.
So we are incorporating research that adds asphalt polymers to traditional ways of making asphalt. And think about this, more than 300 million tons of asphalt pavement were put down last year in the U.S. So not only can we make, can we replace petroleum with a domestic product that is renewable and that is sustainably raised, but we can use it. It works better, the asphalt lasts longer, and the asphalt sealant, different soybean product, is non-toxic to applicators, goes on super easily, lasts longer, and helps states maintain their federal infrastructure dollars by maintaining their infrastructure. So,
cool.
I mean, those are two super big markets that we're working on right now, among others like motor oil and paint
yep.
and powder coatings and all kinds
yep.
of stuff. The list is endless.
Absolutely. Okay, cool. Early on, you said about pushing more soybeans offshores to those importing countries. We're starting a project that's going to make it more efficient for us to do that with the dredging on the Mississippi. What's the latest there?
Yeah, so United Soybean Board can't fund infrastructure directly, but we can fund research to make the infrastructure happen more efficiently. So we funded some research that is leading to the actual dredging of the Mississippi, which allows us, to your point, to maintain and strengthen our global competitiveness. We can make soybeans hit the market in higher quantities and certainly more cost-effective shipments to those global point, global ports. So our research showed that the dredging project will save about 13 cents a bushel on freight while mm-hmm. increasing the load by about 500,000 bushels per ocean vessel. So that's a realized value for U.S. soy farmers and the U.S. soy complex of about savings of about $461 million annually. So when we think about efficiency of getting our beans to ports, this is going to go a long way toward the efficiency
yeah.
of transportation.
13 cents a bushel, that comes right back to the farmer, and it, or it should, part of it should find its way back to the farmer.
Well, you bet. You bet. That's,
yeah.
I mean, that's why we do it by the bushel. And so
yeah.
The Army Corps of Engineers is proceeding with the project. They started in the summer of 2020. So we're just looking forward to getting a new depth in the Mississippi for this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the infrastructure is so important. When you look at a U.S. map, you can see that every Midwestern state contains a river that connects to the Mississippi. It's probably the most essential waterway, at least in the U.S. and one of the most in the world. And as our global competitors invest in infrastructure at a much higher rate than we are in this country, and we've fallen well behind,
yeah.
the dredging project is super important to farmers.
Absolutely, and it is part of the road or the path to recovery from this COVID crisis that we are in, and it's part about making U.S. agriculture as efficient as we can possibly make it. Polly, thank you so much. We'll talk with you again soon.
All right, sounds good. Thank you.
You bet. That is Polly Rulin. She is the CEO of United Soybean Board. Coming up next, we're going to talk to Brian Grady. He's coming back. Let's talk crop tour here on AgriTalk.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com. But there was a time
back in my prime when I could really. I have no idea why they're playing that bump music for Brian Grady, Pro Farmer Editor, but they are. So, Beej, I mean, you got anything to say about that bump for you?
No, I'm probably not as good as I once was.
Oh, Brian Grady, Pro Farmer Editor, director of the Pro Farmer Crop Tour. How you doing, Beej?
Oh, I'm all right, Chip.
Okay. 2 weeks to go, basically, until we gather in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, before we gather out in Columbus, Ohio. And the gathering, to start things off, going to be a little smaller than what we've gotten used to on Crop Tour. But nonetheless, we're going to gather. We're going to go out and scout, and we're going to go out and pull samples. And we're going to do it as a team. But let's talk about how the scouting is going to be different this year, Beej.
Well, we've purposely dialed it back. International scouts weren't invited this year for COVID reasons. Many of them couldn't get flights anyway. Even if they could, we just didn't extend that invitation. We also don't have a lot of our scouts that would normally come from the investment world out on the East Coast. Just a lot of them, either they can't get flights or their companies haven't opened up travel yet. USDA will not be a part of our scouting this year. And they've always sent scouts in the past, and the government just hasn't freed up travel for them. So, it's going to be mostly farmers this year. And we have a large contingent of farmers anyway, but it'll be almost exclusively farmers this year. Media, a lot of them are covering from a distance, not participating in tour this year. So, and because of company travel restrictions once again. And so that'll be the differences. We're going to still run the same routes, but the numbers will be lighter. Evening meetings are going to be virtual. Go ahead.
Yeah, let's stick to the routes here for just a second, because I think this is so important. We're running the same routes that we always have. And as more and more people start to contact me about this, there's still, I think, a misunderstanding of how tour is run. We don't all jump on a bus and head out and stop at pre-selected fields. On the eastern leg of the tour, we run 12 different routes, and we've been running those routes for several years. Out west, since 1998, we've been running 10 different routes. One of the reasons that we run fewer routes out west is because there's fewer roads to get us to where we need to be, while still maintaining some separation between the routes. But we're going to be running those same routes. We're just going to have fewer people doing it. And when I hear that combination, Brian, what I hear in my head is fewer samples.
Yeah, we'll definitely be down on samples, I think. The only way we could get close on samples is if we have enough tour scouts to make sure we double up those routes. So we'd be able to split them. And so one group would do the first half of the route and the second group would do the second half of the route and so on. But when you have fewer scouts and you're covering the same distance, just logic says that the numbers are going to be lighter. So that's part of the challenge this year is to make sure we get a representative sample over the same sample area. Things are different. Everything's different in today's world right now than what it was in the past. And we'll adapt, and that's what you have to do in situations like this.
Yeah, and we're going to be traveling in teams of two this year, when normally we'd try to have four people per vehicle. This year it's just going to be two people per vehicle. And, again, it's in an effort to maintain some social distancing out there on the road. Evening meetings. Talk about the evening meetings, because, boy, there's a big change there.
That's probably actually the biggest change when we get right down to it, because in the past we've done an evening meeting on the eastern side and we've done an evening meeting on the western side. large congregations of farmers. That's not going to happen this year. We were going to have one virtual meeting where we bring both the east and the west sides together. So I'll talk about the eastern side along with some of my scouts. Jeff Wilson, he'll talk about the western side along with some of his scouts, and we'll give observations. We'll go through the data like we always have. It's just going to be a combined meeting, so we'll have four of those meetings Monday through Thursday. And like I said, there'll be both sides coming together in one meeting.
Yeah, and I'm going to be in South Bend, Indiana, trying to help coordinate that evening meeting and maintain a flow of information from east to west so that we don't jumble things up and keep the presentation as clear as we possibly can on this. Because, you know, in the past, it's been pretty easy to separate it. Now, with new people that have never been exposed to a crop tour meeting before, we're going to have to work hard at making sure that people understand, okay, now we're talking about Ohio, now we're talking about South Dakota. Here we are in northeast Nebraska versus what we saw in Indiana. So it's going to be an effort to make sure that the information that we provide is provided with some clarity, and I'm going to be in South Bend trying to make sure that that happens. The other thing that's going to be happening while I'm in South Bend is I'm going to be working on the data collection, and as that data rolls in, we're going to be going through all of our normal checks, we're going to add something to it to make sure that we don't get too heavy on one district compared to the past. Okay, we know how many samples we normally pull out of a crop district, so we're going to convert that to a percentage and of the total number of samples pulled per state, and we're going to make sure that everything is still kind of lining up so that we don't skew the data compared to past tours. Because, Beej, if we can't compare to the past data, we don't have anything to really present.
Right. And, you know, crop tour is based on the data. And like you said, the data in comparison to what we saw last year, what we've seen over the past 3 years, the history of the tour, so on and so forth. And so it's all about the data.
Exactly. Okay. To sign up for those evening meetings, go to profarmer.com or farmjournalfielddays.com and get signed up. When you're at farmjournalfielddays.com, sign up for the Farm Journal Field Days and for the benefit concert. And guys, it's all free. Thank you, Brian. Come back this afternoon. We got Kevin Marcus right here on AgriTalk.